sahanavavatu, sahanabhunaktu, sahavīryam karavāvahai, tejasvināvadhitamastamavidvishāvahai. Shanti, shanti, shanti. Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shrivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
So page 25, Nectar Devotion, Bhava. Strong attachment, asakti, is gradually transformed into bhava, or spontaneous spiritual emotion. Bhava later climaxes into rati, or the first stirrings of divine love. Eternality, absolute knowledge and divine bliss, Satchidananda, are emanations of the original state of consciousness, or the Sarup. Bhava is the budding blossom of these three energies, Satchit and Ananda. Bhava has also been described as the gleaming blossoms of the creeper of devotion. The sweet, far-reaching fragrance of the blossoms of bhava sends enchanting invitations to the Supreme Lord, gently inducing him to appear in person before his devotee. Furthermore, when the soul's natural sentiments are even faintly scented by bhava, they melt and flow unrestrained towards the Supreme Lord, bathing his divine form with love. In bhava bhakti, the devotee focuses his mind with unwavering attention on the Supreme Lord. In sleeping, waking, or dreaming, he always remembers Krishna. With incessant and intense desire to properly serve the Lord, the devotee in bhava rediscovers his original spiritual form. Naturally and perfectly gliding into that form, he more or less discards his sadhaka tabernacle. Now his sentiment, his entire being, yearns to be transformed into a bumblebee, humming and searching for honey around the lotus feet of the Supreme Lord. So here is that the attachment transfers into bhava, and then that into the specific state, then rati. Rati is that attachment, that great attachment for Krishna. So we'll see that this is what one is trying to bring bhava to, where this stage of having that total and complete attraction to the Lord, right? This purva rag, because that means then the attachment or that attraction is so great, there's nothing else that is of interest. So there's no distraction. There's not something else that's going to create a problem in the devotional progress, right? So here now they're discussing about, because this is being discussed for us, the stage of where someone is practicing this within his form, within the present, his sadhaka rupa. So through meditation, then these activities or elements are going on, right? They're not, so he says here, he just naturally, naturally and perfectly gliding into that form. So he is able to appreciate his spiritual form, adjust with that, and be able to function on that platform. Is that mat folded in half? Or the one up there? No, that's it. Yeah. Is that folded? Could it be unfolded? And then he can sit. So making the point that he more or less discards Meaning, he's still in that form, but basically speaking, he's not paying much attention. Right? He's not paying much attention to that. So all his focus is within the, you know, the Krishna conscious environment, within the spiritual world. But that's being done through meditation. Right? Yes.
Sometimes rati is used synonymously to bhava.
Yes, but since here he's used them both as a progression, then bhava will be the overall, you could say, mood of ecstasy, but rati then being specifically that intense attraction. Right? Because then that will turn into rati. Right? Because the sakti will turn into bhava, and bhava will then turn into rati. Right. Does that make sense? Because you're still dealing with a sadhana here. But this is not sadhaka meaning on this plane, like this. This is bhava sadhana. So it's generally just called bhava bhakti. But sadhana bhakti is called sadhana bhakti. Right? You know, and generally bhava bhakti, prema bhakti. But it's also a sadhana. You know, it's going through these stages. The devotee at this stage has acquired a priceless treasure trove, but he hides his wealth like a miser. His spiritual sentiments are bhava, and displays only abject poverty. Ordinary people are unable to appreciate the value of riches, which, such as qualities of austerity, tolerance, and forgiveness in a person, whereas wise saints shower laurels on him. A non-devotee considers pure devotees like those to be either scatterbrained or mad, right? So others will generally think something's not going well here, right? Because he doesn't pay attention to anything. He's not absorbed in anything. Nothing on the material platform means anything to him. So the rest of the family members or other associates, they'll think he's, you know, gone crazy like that. But the those who are wise, then they'll understand what's happening. The symptoms that embellish the sublime sentiments of bhava are magnificent. The devotee's eyes are constantly inebriated from seeing the beauty of Brajendranandana Krishna, his complexion the color of a monsoon cloud, his pinkish lips, his compassionate eyes, the brilliance of his perfect moon-like face with its innocent, gentle smile, his shining yellow dress and radiant jewels. The devotee's voice chokes up as he perceives the beauty of his Lord, and tears flow incessantly, saturating his body. His eager ears strain to hear the haunting melody of Krishna's flute. His captivated honeyed voice, they strain to hear all the instructions on serving and worshipping his lotus feet. The devotee experiencing bhava bhakti restlessly moves about trying to collect any information about his beloved Lord and how to serve him. The bhava bhakta sometimes pauses in one spot, rooted to the ground as if he is trying to hear a faint voice, moving his head in different directions in order to hear better. Then Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes in a commentary on Shloka 6 of Sri Shikshastakam. This particular spiritual platform is marked by 9 symptoms. 1. The devotee is tolerant and unperturbed even when faced with a very distressing situation. 2. He is averse to wasting time. 3. And 3. Utilizes all his time in the Lord's service. 4. He is prideless. And 5. Has complete conviction he will attain the Lord's lotus feet. 6. Extremely eager and anxious to attain perfection. He has acquired a taste for chanting the holy name. And 7. A strong attachment for hearing and speaking about the pastimes and attributes of Lord Krishna. 8. He has no interest in anything that has no direct link to Krishna. And 9. Has developed love for the places of Lord Krishna's pastimes. Scriptures say that one who has developed these symptoms is on the threshold of entering the stage of full bhava. So He's not interested in anything he's not direct linked. So that means he's only interested in the direct hearing, chanting, remembering, you know, worshiping the deity, living in the Dham. So all the things that have been utilized before, elements of indirect service, means taking aspects of the conditioned nature and connecting those to the Lord. He doesn't have any interest in that anymore. Now it's just hearing, chanting, remembering. Yes.
So, but for preaching purposes, he might kind of snap out of it?
No, for preaching purposes, then they'll work within a, you know, a framework. But that's taking that mood. But in their own inherent, they have no interest. So they're taking up that platform to engage, you know, and engage others specifically. Because if they act on this platform, who can take it as an example and follow? Right? So then they have to work with the indirect, because that's what everybody else basically is going to be doing. But they're going to give this, still this focus, right? The principle of it. Because the principle is always be absorbed in Krishna, right? So the principle is that he is tolerant, undisturbed when faced with a situation, doesn't like to waste time, uses his time to serve the Lord. So these things will be preached. But for the general devotee, these will just be practices in his sadhana. Right? He'll intellectually understand and try to apply that. Here it's not coming from the intellectual platform, it's just naturally springing from the heart because of his absorption in Krishna. Krishna means that remembrance of Krishna is so wonderful that anything else is not wonderful. So there's no interest to do anything else. Right? You wouldn't want to distract yourself doing something when you could be absorbed in Krishna. Does that make sense? Nothing bothers you, because why would something bother you unless you have some investment in it? Does that make sense? Let's say we're managing something and then someone else is making politics and trying to disturb our position. That will bother us. Why? Because of our conditioning that we're naturally engaged as a manager. Right? So it's our conditioning that will create the problem. But here you're not dealing with that. So, you know, if the service is there, they do that. But if others want to do it, it doesn't bother you. It's not necessary to remember Krishna. You understand? The secondary aspects aren't essential for being, for doing service, right? But for, in the conditioned state, without engaging the conditioned nature, the tendency is one won't be fully absorbed, right? The recommendation is just be fully absorbed, but if you can't, then you engage your conditioned nature. Does that make sense? So, therefore, there's nothing to be disturbed about. So he'll be tolerant. Nothing will bother him, because it's just, you know, Krishna's arrangement. This is something to deal with, and you deal in the moment with what's there, right? Because we'll look at so many things. What will be lost? So then the mode of ignorance comes up. What things that we wanted to gain in the future that we won't be able to gain? So the mode of passion comes up. You understand? This is where the problem comes. But right now, it's a matter of the person saying this, and if it's wrong, or, you know, if it's something to deal with, then you talk to the proper people, explain to them what it is, or, you know, you understand? Does that make sense? Like that. It's a different thing, because you're dealing in the present, but for Krishna, so you're in pure goodness. It's the passion and ignorance that create the distress. Oh, if this happens, then all this will happen, and then all this will fall apart, and all this. So you're just starting to go off into the future. Or think about how in the past this happened, and this. You understand? So the distraction is based on the modes of passion and ignorance. But for someone on this platform, there is no passion or ignorance, right? That basically disappeared at Ruchi. Right? So now it's like they're very well situated, now that attachment to Krishna is there. So nothing on the material platform bothers you. Right? Yes?
Bharat Maharaj.
Bharat Maharaj.
That he had to take birth as a deer.
He had to take birth as a deer.
And then when he was at the end of his life as a deer, he was hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam from the sages, and remembering the Lord, but still have to take much more birth. It's a jump in time.
What's the problem? You know what I'm saying? So he has to take these births. So what's the difficulty?
My question is that why he has to take one more birth is not a
mind. But no, but what does that have to do with what we're discussing? You know what I'm saying? Because here it's saying the devotee is tolerant and unperturbed even when faced with a very distressing situation. So it's not that, the question is not why would the Uttamadikari be in a distressful situation. The point is that being in a distressful situation, he's not bothered. That's the symptom. You understand? Does that make sense? Right. So now if Jarabharat goes back to Godhead as a deer, so how is that example going to work for you? Right? So how you'll follow in his footsteps? Wherever the ashram is, go kind of a little bit of a distance, you know, would be the normal, look at around what other deers do, and stay that far away, get down on your hands and knees, eat a lot of grass, and remember the Lord. Right? Is that what you're going to do? No. So therefore, the point is that example can be set from human species. Right? That's the species that is the general principle. You know what I'm saying? Because the birth, death, old age, and disease, in one sense, is not the actual problem. The problem is we're attached to it, and not to Krishna. That's why you suffer. But we see here, there's a great devotees, they're not attached to it, so they don't suffer. Right? So we'll look at it as bad. But for them, what does it matter? You're in Krishna's creation, you can remember Krishna. So what situation is not favorable? We're looking at it from our concept of piety and impiety. So to take birth again is impious. And so, therefore, and because we perform devotional work, then we should get a pious result, which would mean that wouldn't happen. You understand? So we're looking at it from our own considerations as opposed to, you know, the particular pastime that's going on. Does that make sense? Right. Because are there any specific instructions being given as a deer? Right? But as Jarabharat, now is there some instructions? Right? So the instructions we receive from this particular living entity comes in that birth as Jarabharat. Right? There's no instructions given, you know, specifically as Bharat Maharaj or as the deer. Right? So therefore, then we have something is left for us, something of benefit. Is that okay? Yes.
Can we say that these symptoms of Baba Bhakti is, we can say, the state of Babaji?
State of Babaji?
Means,
No. These are just the natural sentiments.
The Babaji are supposed to be in that...
It's not Babaji, it's the stage of Paramahamsa, or at least Hamsa. You know what I'm saying? Babaji is a at least in our consideration, will be a particular situation you will place yourself into to perform your bhajan. You know, as opposed to a ghosti nandi or this or that. But this is a state of consciousness where he's not bothered by anything material. He's only absorbed in spending his time, you know, connected to Krishna. He has a taste for hearing and chanting about Krishna, right? And he has no interest in anything that's not connected to Krishna. And he has a complete interest in things that are connected to Krishna. So that's the elements that we're looking for. Does that make sense? Like that. So the Babaji is a situation. Like that, you know, whatever works for you. Because we see is that our acharyas, they don't take up the Babaji, you know, as a ritual, right? There's no ceremony as such or anything. They just start living that lifestyle, right? When that's favorable. And then when otherwise, then they go out. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he goes and sits in the forest up the road here and just chants, right? He lives, makes a, has a little grass hut, and when it rains, because it leaks, he puts up an umbrella, right, while he's inside, right, just chants. But then if there's some preaching opportunity, he goes out and preaches. And then he comes back. So he's more Babaji than anybody who has gone through the ceremony except as a Babaji Vaish. You understand? So it's just the situation. Because it's beyond Varnashram. So technically there's no ritual, you know, as such, that element like that. But if one's looking at it from the state of sannyas, like that, then there's a ritual, given a ritual. Like that. Is that right? This bhava is of two kinds. Raga bhakti upta, springing from spontaneous devotional service, and vaidhi bhakti upta, springing from regulated devotional service. So this is the point, is one can come to the platform of bhava, whether it comes through raganuga or through vaidhi. This idea is that only through raganuga it's going to happen. No, it can happen either way. It's whatever naturally happens. Right? A devotee displaying the first kind of bhava, Rag Bhakti Utta, denounces worship in awe and reverence because he shies away from any awareness of position, jati, and scriptural knowledge and edicts, pramana. One relates to the Lord more or less on equal terms, thus lending depth and weight to his particular bhava. He shies away, it means that it's not because of the rule that's why he's following, right? He just has that natural inclination to serve Krishna, not because the rule, because that's his natural inclination. Does that make sense? So this idea is, oh no, we don't worry about position, we don't worry about scripture, we don't quote anything, we don't do that. That's Raghunath, that's not Raghunath. That's just externalizing the process and making it into a ritual. The point is the particular forms of the rituals aren't what causes his devotion. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? Let us say, the second kind lacks the intensity of the jati and pramana sentiment, and therefore bhava becomes influenced by the opulences of the Lord, thus reducing its weight and depth. Hence, these two varieties of bhava are relished by its two kinds of devotees, respectively, in hearts laden with transcendental desire to serve in two ways. Right? So, here is also giving the direction of the how it is that someone will come to that platform of bhava, but, you know, be interested in more the rules and regulations, and how someone will come there and not be. But, as pointed out by the I think same author, that coming to bhava, then at that time one develops. Right? So, but the difficulty is that if there's already that intensity before, but it's not something that it's a natural element, then that early stages will be very quick. If not, one will get also into the rituals and everything in the Vrindavan life. Does that make sense? Because the Brajbasis have schedules, they have things they do, they have duties. But one will get into those because that's what one does. One does vaidhi, one follows because this is what one's supposed to. So at some point then that has to be left for the natural element of rag. Right? Then that spontaneous element, that will give the drive to develop that sentiment of the residence of Vrindavan. Right? They have that sentiment, but there's a form it's manifested through, rather than the form is the cause of the sentiment. Does that make sense? Okay, now we'll give the example. Just as, let's say, every day there's darshanartik, right? And they're there, and, you know, conch blows and this and that, and there's, you know, some excitement, right? Now, if it's a festival, big festival, right? And there's, you know, it's something special. Everyone knows it's going to be something special. Special arrangements are made. Why? Because on a festival day, you dress the deities more opulently. There's more, you know, nice arrangements or some other things like that. So understanding that element because of the arrangements, Then, before the curtain opens, everybody's more excited. You understand? That's why they're there, to create that, because every day you may not, but at least on these days, then you increase it. Right? But we're saying the rag, it doesn't matter if the arrangements are there or not, one is very ecstatic anyway. You know, and then these other things can increase, but it's not that you require the forms to increase it. Does that make sense? That's why it's not a matter of just following some ritual. You know what I'm saying? It's a natural state, you know, which comes earlier or later. It doesn't matter, you know. This whole idea that it has to come now and can't come later. No, it's whenever it manifests, that's when it happens.
So it means it comes from its own.
Raganuga means it's not based on having external features. Right? In other words, its inspiration is not based on following rules. But it doesn't mean you're not following rules. It doesn't mean that its inspiration is not based on following rules. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You know, just be like, let's say someone's you're playing a game, right? Now, you have those who, you know, the game is there, it has its form, there's all the elements that are there, you have the field, it's just right, everyone has their uniforms, you got all the rules, you have the referee, you know, you have all that, you know, so then doing all those things, doing all the right moves, doing all the different things, all the different patterns of the game, that's what's inspiring. Does that make sense? For someone else, it's just playing the game and having fun. They follow the rules, but the rules aren't what causes their inspiration. You understand? So it's just two different things. So the one, if it's done long enough, then naturally it'll turn into, it becomes spontaneous. But there are those who prefer that, and it doesn't. Does that make sense? You know, so those going to Vaikuntha, going to Dwarka, but it doesn't go beyond that. Does that make sense? Though it will be more formal in Vaikuntha and less formal in Dwarka, but still that the rules are an important medium of expression. Is that okay? Yes.
You just described how Sanaka attains Bhava and then develops this grief and performs Raganuga.
Yes. Yes.
This is still done, as you said in the very beginning, in meditation, already having spiritual form.
Yeah, it's done in meditation. It can also apply to if you've left the body and now you've been born into Braj in your Swarup, then it's still the same difference. The point is you're still the same soul. You know what I'm saying? This idea is that it's just some magic. No, it's, you're the same person. So how much you're attached to Krishna, that much you're going to be attached there. Does that make sense? So now you have, but now instead of having a material body, you have a spiritual body. Right? The qualification meaning you thought of Krishna at the time of death. Right? But now if you're still attached to, you know, you're still functioning on rules, you're still going to function there. So the point is Bhava can be, he's explaining from our position how through meditation you are performing Bhav Sadhana. But it can also mean that someone who has left the Sadhaka Rupa and has the Sarup, right, that, both elements, right? But what we're distinguishing here is between the Raganuga and the Vaidhi, reasons for upliftment, right? But the point is the Vaidhi will turn into Rag at an earlier point or a later point. Does that make sense? Yes.
So we could say that Bhava Bhakta is completely spiritual, although his spiritual mentality is not yet perfected.
No, it's perfect, but Prema is more perfect than that. Right? Because Brahma Bhuta we call perfection. So Bhava starts from Brahma-Bhuta. Does that make sense? Because there's no material connection. So that's why he doesn't worry, as I mentioned before, he doesn't worry about, you know, the bodily condition. So others think he's crazy because in the material platform, everybody worries about their material condition. But he's not, so that would mean he must be nuts. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Yes.
It says here that the devotee shies away.
Shies away. Yeah, it means that he doesn't have, you know, there's no dynamic interest. You know what I'm saying? So it's not the rule that's commanding the devotion. The devotion is naturally nourishing itself. Right? Doesn't mean he can't follow rules or won't follow them. But he shies away that it's the rule that's going to make it good. You know what I'm saying? But in our mind, then that means, you know, from the impersonal concept, that would mean, therefore, he doesn't follow any rules. No, it's being beyond the rules means they're not what control you. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? What makes, let's say, just as a general thing, this is not anything specific, what makes it, you know, socially or the mood, what makes a bank manager a bank manager? Or an accountant, you know, a chartered accountant?
His ability in mathematics and dealing with people. Together.
But the dealings are based on? So you're trying to bring out the spontaneous aspect there.
Trustworthy.
It's rules. That's why they're, you know, they're very, you know, cut and dry. Everything's done in the very, like this, and, you know, nothing spontaneous. If there was something spontaneous, you'd think something's wrong here. You know?
We had some bank managers a couple of years ago that was pretty spontaneous.
Okay.
It went pretty bad.
Yeah, yeah.
The financial crisis.
Yeah, yeah. You can't be. You know, businessman maybe, but the banks, no. They're very, you know. Does that make sense? So the point is, it's just the rules make the lifestyle. Well, the spontaneity means the rules aren't the foundation of the lifestyle. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah, because it's someone else's money, so you can't lose it.
If it's
your money, you can lose it.
Someone had looked at the stockbrokers and found that they were more risky with other people's money than psychopaths were, clinically psychopaths. They took more risks.
Not their own,
that's the point, yeah. Not their own.
Yeah, because if the idiot's stupid enough to leave the money with him.
That's...
Now we shall discuss the different ways of relishing that rasa. Sweetness is present in different foods in varying degrees. Jackfruit is sweeter than mango, sugarcane sweeter than jackfruit, and raisins sweeter than the rest. Similarly, the different devotees relish varying intensities of bhava according to their taste. And this produces five variations. It's interesting is what he goes through here. You have mango, then jackfruit, then sugarcane, and then raisins. We don't think of it that raisins are the sweetest, so that's why they're put into the various preparations, right? Because of our conditioning, that there's some inherent problem with sugar. So we don't make the distinction. If it's more sweet, it must be something wrong. But the point is it's sweeter. That's why it's used in these sweet preparations for Krishna. Right? Because it brings out, it's already sweet, and then you get this little bit burst of something more. You understand? That's why attachment to mundane considerations can get in the way of the natural devotional, you know, culture. Similarly, the different devotees relish varying intensities of bhava according to their taste. Right? So it's pointing out all of it's sweet, but there's different intensities. And this produces five variations. Shanta, neutral, dasya, servitude, shakya, friendship, vatsalya, parental, and madhurya, conjugal. Bhava is thus displayed as serenity in shanta bhakta, in a Shanta Bhakta, as affection in a Dasya Bhakta, as camaraderie in a Shakya Bhakta, as filial love in a Vatsalya Bhakta, and conjugal love in a Madhurya Bhakta. These five kinds of rasa, according to their will, modify themselves as Vibhava, Anubhava, and Vyabhichari Bhava. Then Stai Bhava, the reigning king of Bhava, surrounded by his subjects, the other Bhavas, and in alliance with them, is transformed into the five rasas, Shanta, Dasya, Shakya, Vatsalya, and Madhurya. In other words, Bhava becomes metamorphosed into rasa. The following quotation from the Vedas lends authority to this. Quote, the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the embodiment of rasa, and the jivas exult upon receiving it. I think that's Taittiriya Upanishad. Oh, that's what the other part is. Okay. So the rasas themselves modify according to Vibhava, Anubhava, and Vyabhichari Bhava. So Stai Bhava is the actual position. It means these five, if that's the that's one's Stai Bhava, what one is fixed in. Right? Because Stai means fixed. It doesn't change. Mother Yashoda isn't one day, you know, into parental rasa, and the next day she wants to go out and play with the cowherd boys, you know. It's always the same. So it's Stai. These other ones, they adjust, right, around it. So the point is that this bhava is there, so it transforms into this rasa because that Stai becomes fixed. It becomes prominent. Because one has one's position, but one has to adjust with it and be completely absorbed, right? Because the point is someone on the platform of these rasas, all they are thinking about is Krishna in relationship to this rasa. There's not a moment of the day that goes by that Mother Yashoda is not thinking about Krishna in relationship to the parental exchange. Right? So the point is until it comes to complete samadhi, it hasn't come to that point of being fixed. You understand? Though one has the form, and one will say that form is for that. That is your intent. You're associating with those. But here we see it becomes transformed. So they're making the distinction within this, you know, this general category of, you know, being transcendentally situated. Does that make sense? So it's coming because the absorption is complete. Right, as he said before, is that it gives rise to rati. When that rati comes, it's completely attached to Krishna in that way, and you never think of anything else. Because before samadhi, then there's, you know, generally thinking, but not as deep, or, you know, basically meditating, but not always as focused. And then it's like generally always thinking of it, occasionally not, or, you know, regularly thinking about, or occasionally thinking about, right? These are all your, like, five stages of meditation. Right? So when it comes to samadhi, one's totally thinking about, then you could say, then Stai Bhava is actually real. Right? Just like we say before, nishta. So the nishta bhakti is there, that is being, it's being performed because anartha nivriti has been accomplished, but as we can see by the discussion, there's still anarthas that continue past. But the bulk is done enough where the taste for the holy name can come up. So therefore, then, it's also that stage after anartha nivriti is considered bhava. So that means then you're actually fixed, because there is no material conditioning, right? Because that's what you're doing. Nishta means you're not affected by the material conditioning. So bhava means there isn't any material conditioning, right? So it's a similar, you get these, so it's bhava, so you have the same thing. You have the form, but it becomes actually having the form when the mentality is there, because the external is not the rasa. You know what I'm saying? It's the mentality. That's the whole point. It's not the body. You know, as we see as an example of Prajumna, then as Cupid, when he, tried his tricks on Lord Shiva, and it didn't work out so good for him, you know, and he got burnt to ashes. Then when he took birth again, then there was his wife before, who's named Rati. then she happened to be working in the kitchen where he was found, right? Because he was found inside the belly of a big fish, right? So then she came along with him back to the palace and all this, and raised him. So she was, you know, she has the her form, right? It doesn't change. She's Rati, right? She's the wife of Cupid. And she's dealing with him as parental rasa, right? Until he comes of age. And then suddenly the mood changes, and he's kind of presumed, it's like, hey, what's going on here? You know, and then she explains everything, and then, you know, then it's fine. You understand? The form was the same, but the mood made the difference in rasa, right? You have friends, parents, and conjugal lovers who are in the and servants who are in the feminine form. Right? Like cows are feminine, right? And they're in Shantaras. So it's not the form that specifically defines the rasa. It's the mentality. That's why we see in all this, he's just bringing out mentality. He's not talking about technique here. Here it's within refining the mood to make sure that you understand that there's more. There's that total immersion. One's absorbed, but there's total immersion. Therefore, there's these stages are there. But before, there's some mechanics to it. There's a technique, right? So Prabhupada Nectar devotees, techniques of hearing and chanting. They're techniques because we don't have the taste. You have the taste. What's the need of a technique? Right? Technique is to absorb yourself so that you just do it. Right? Like I've seen, you have, you know, somebody, he wants to learn music, so he gets the teacher, they teach him some technique, how to hold it, how to do this and that, you get the proper sound, and then they go through exercises and all that, right? But then someone else just has an interest in it, goes over, picks it up, sits down and plays with it, makes a lot of noise until they finally figure out do it this way, you get the good noise, right? And then they put their fingers on there and start playing with it, and then it also is not in tune, but after a while they get it where it's in tune. So they, without technique, have learned how to play it. You understand? Because of that just natural inspiration, they just want to learn this. Well, the other has to take support from technique. Right? But the point is, it's just what's natural. In other words, if it doesn't come spontaneously, follow technique. But this idea is that because spontaneous is higher, therefore, and because I'm special and I'm the highest, therefore I won't follow any technique and I'm going to get a result. That's called foolish. That's the meaning of sahaja. Sahaja means easy. Yes?
Those five levels of perfecting remembrance of Krishna, Sanusmriti, and it ends with Samadhi. Those are on the level of bhava or previous?
Yes, they're in the third stage of bhava, the smarana dasa. It means in remembrance. It's not that one's not remembering all the way through. It's not that I do this and when that's finished and this and that's, because we've seen from the earlier stages, they're just complete. You've already been meditating on Krishna since Shraddha, the beginning stages. But now it's come to the point where you can actually say there's some proper meditation going on. Right? So it's occasional that there'll be that, you know, full absorption, but then it'll go out. Then it becomes regular. Right? And then it becomes basically you're always remembering, but sometimes not. Right? Then it becomes you're meditating, but it's not very, its intensity is not. So when that intensity becomes full, where it's dynamic, then that's samadhi. Because then from there you can do something with it. Does that make sense?
So in the beginning of bhava, one does not taste rasa continuously, but at the end,
yeah,
does.
Yeah, because otherwise, if one was tasting rasa continuously, then why would you have the situation when Krishna calls the gopis, some of them can't go. Right? So the ones that are fully absorbed, they go. The ones that in being stopped from going become fully absorbed, then they also go. The ones who are becoming stopped, then, you know, it doesn't immediately happen. Then then they, by being staying in their rooms, and then they come to that platform. You know what I'm saying? So that total absorption has to be there. Because if that's not complete, how do you function within that? Because Krishna doesn't occasionally remember you and occasionally and then some, or regularly remember you and then, you know. Right? He always remembers the living entities, right? And the devotees, and he's fully absorbed. So unless you're fully absorbed, how will there be rasa? How will there be the exchange? Because if you're, you know what I'm saying? If you're talking to somebody and they're looking at television or something like that, you know, yeah, like that, and they go back to like that. Are you satisfied? No. And only if you say something really insane, then they stop and, you know, like that. But it's got to be way better than their program, right? Does that make sense? So, does that make sense? So that's the point, is when it comes there, then one can, it attracts Krishna's attention for direct interaction. Because before that, it's indirect, but Krishna, remembering Krishna, it is non-different from him. But there is the direct interaction. Otherwise, why would there be a difference between Sambhog and Vipralamba? There's a difference in flavor, though they're non-different. They're both fully him. Is that? Yes.
Is this just a distraction from the example, or is it some relevance to it? The less sweet fruit is mango, and it's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's favorite fruit.
No, that wouldn't be the same. That's a distraction. It's not his favorite fruit. So, you know, if you're on the spontaneous platform, does it become more sweet? But then, you know, but if the parrot bites it, then it's legal. Is it as sweet as a jackfruit? You know,
how ripe is it?
Yeah. And then the thing would be taking the one who are.
There's just an example of showing that the principle is sweetness, and that. You're just showing that you have the mango, but jackfruit is sweeter than that. Sugarcane is sweeter than that, and then the raisins. So it's just showing that there are different levels of intensifying sweetness, right? You know, because the mango is a pleasant sweetness, right? Your jackfruit is quite strong sweetness. You know, very strong. But it's not intense, it's just extremely sweet. Now sugar cane, that can start to have an intensity. Right? And raisins are very intense. You know, I mean, there's like an aggression to them almost. And saying, so that's the thing, is they become sweeter, then they're more, you know, aggressive in showing their, you know, Mother Yashoda is generally going nice. If Krishna doesn't come in, then only she'll show. And she'll go out and say, you're not a street boy. Like that. But we only hear, you know, that example, you know, or in the Damodar Lila, you know, and these are famous. But for the gopis, this is just standard everyday stuff, right? They've been waiting for him all day, and then he shows up, and then they ignore him. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point. Its intensity is just so much greater. You understand? It's the same principle. Rasa is rasa. Like that, you know. And these are within that. And then you have a taste, you know, but it doesn't even compare. There's a taste within the emotional rasa, you know, of, you know, doing something proper within a relationship, tasting that interaction that's based on proper interaction of relationship. Right? And then you have the taste of proper interaction of the senses with the sense objects. Right? Does that make sense? So we can see from that, Shastra's only defining rasa, really. You know, and the techniques of it and the situations of it. Because it's just telling you that what you have to do, what time you have to eat, what you have to do. And we'll say, well, I can do whatever I want. Yeah, but if you eat at noontime, you'll digest it. Yes. Right? The sun's up, it's at its zenith, it's fire, it's fire in your stomach. They have some connection. You know, you eat a big meal at midnight, you know, unless you're going to, you know, rave all night, you got a problem. You know what I'm saying? So, therefore, it says what to do. So then the senses and the sense objects get the complete rasa. You know what I'm saying? But the point is to understand that this rasa is nothing compared to the emotional rasa. That's why sensual rasa can be given up for emotional. You know what I'm saying? You know, and that emotional, that rasa, it's being explained that if you have relationships, you deal in this way, you have these duties, you interact, then you'll get that. Otherwise, you won't. You know, I'm free, I do whatever I want. And they don't get. You know, they're not getting. You know, and then, so they show how to get, but they're showing that that being gotten, that's the limit of it. But then there's beyond, there's the spiritual rasa. So that's the process, is that if we're attached to this, to the sensual and emotional, then they're engaged according to regulations so that you actually can see it. Because if you don't, you'll always hanker for it even though you can't have it. Just like give an example. When we started the martial arts class, now there was a discussion about who would be qualified, right? So naturally you'd pick those who had more physical strength or, you know, great focus and, you know, things like that. But then, all because it was coming up, all the different kids are talking about it. You know, they're all interested, right? Every little kid wants to be a martial artist, you know, just, you know, boom, and the guy goes flying, you know, they need all these kind of stuff. You know, they all want to be the man. So when the class opened, anybody who wants can be in it. Right? So practically speaking, except for two or three guys, which was, you know, really obvious they could figure out, they're not going to make it. So then everybody went the first day with great enthusiasm and all that. You know, and then they all get in there with these big grins on their face, and then the martial arts teacher tells them, all right, down on the ground, 25 push-ups. And I says, wait a minute. You know, so after the 25 push-ups and sit-ups and the this and the that, then the next day it was probably reduced by half. And then, you know, as this went on and increased, 25 was just starting, you know. Then, you know, after about 2 weeks, it had gone down to the boys that were going to be within the martial arts class for years. So now, within that 2 weeks, you worked out, you know, that someone knows it's not for me. Now, if we had said, no, you can't be in it, you're not strong enough, you're not this and that, they could have gone for years wishing that they could have done it. And then when they got out of the school, they go to, you know, go to some place, find somebody, because now they're away from the, you know, the authority of the school. Now they can do what they want. And then they'll find a teacher, and it, even though it's obvious, it'll take them years to figure it out. So that's the Vedic concept, is that if you have attraction for the senses and the emotions, then deal with them in such a way that you actually experience it, so you can see that it doesn't have any substance. Because otherwise, in our mind, we create that, no, it has substance. It'll be great. And the problem is that the modern idea of speculation means that unlimitedly how you put it together, that's your actual possibilities, real possibilities. Well, the Vedic points out, no, there's laws of nature. There's only certain ways you can get the experience of a particular sense or a particular emotion. It's not going to happen otherwise. That's why there's rules in that, so you actually get it. Because even within that, you have the problem of speculations. Okay, we did that, but I didn't absorb myself this. If I had said this, or if the situation had been different. You know, or, you know what I'm saying? There's always a thing, is then it would have been right. So the Vedic system is that, that main principle and all its details, then rules are there. So you try them all. And now you've tried them all. There isn't anything else. That's it. And you've gotten whatever taste is there. And then it's kind of like, okay, well, that's it. Because how long does it take? That's the thing, is we'll think and go on. It doesn't take long, right? Someone's really enthusiastic about something and is regularly getting that taste. 2 to 3 years, and then they have to re-evaluate it. You know what I'm saying? So the problem is here, person never gets, and they just keep going on, that no, there's something there. And then life ends. Right? And so then you have to be born again to find that something that you're looking for, that was never there. You understand? So the Vedic system, it's regulated so there's only certain ways to do something, because that's all the ways there is. Within that, of course, you can get fine little variations. You know what I'm saying? But it's like, you know, you're cooking, you know, you can boil something, you can bake it, you know, you can braise it, you can fry it. Right? Is there something else?
Roast is a variation of frying.
Roast is braise, like that, you know. But you also get that when you bake, depending upon if you put oil or not, you know. So you can get it then combining those, you can get the different things, right? But there isn't another option. But in the modern concept, it's like whatever you think of, it is an actual real option. No, but I'll take it and I'll, you know, throw it up and it'll bounce off the wall and like that and hit the ground, and then the dog will kick it out there, and then, you know, the cat will pick it up and run off with it, and then, you know, like this, and it'll get soft. So their cooking makes it soft, so this is getting soft, so therefore, and someone else says, that's stupid, you're wasting time. You just take it out, throw it in the street, and the car runs over it and it's soft immediately. Like that. It says, no, but then that car, you know, it might be, you know, whatever, it's not heavy enough. You have to make sure it's a heavy car. So either, you know, some, you know, how you say, government official going by and a bulletproof car runs over it, or you get a truck, or best is a steamroller. But, you know, because the treads in there, you might get some parts not soft, but steamroller will make it nice and smooth. And then someone else says, yeah, but then the quality of the road. You know, so if it's an asphalt road, it has those little pockmarks. If it's a cement road, then you get the fine smash, right? Like this. And so, but all this is just speculation, because you only have four ways to make it to make it cook. Does that make sense? So that's the point. Like that. Of course, unless you're, you know, in Arizona or that, then you have the sidewalk, right? You know, so you can cook on the sidewalk. But I think that would be more like along the way of fried and baked, you know, like that. So I still think it'll fit within the context.
When we were a child in Hyderabad, someone said, if you...
When you were a child in Hyderabad.
Yes, we lived there for 2 years, so...
You were a child in Hyderabad.
Cool.
Okay, great.
If we put an egg on the asphalt, it would cook.
Yes.
And you did it.
Yeah, you always hear about it, but yeah. Yeah, okay, so therefore you have an example of that. You don't have to go all the way to Arizona to fry your eggs on the sidewalk. Right? Does this make sense? So this is what's going on, is that the modern context, that there's going to be some way to be happy that's outside the context of what actually will work. Right? And because of the illusion, then it takes generations for it to adjust until it's dropped as a method to actually make you happy. But, you know, the basic principle of that I'm going to be happy materially remains. You know, so Maya has lots of engagement, right? You know, there's 8,400,000 species, so there's all those varieties of taste. But the point is you're not going to get human taste by using an animal form. No, we wouldn't take mango and try to work it into something else. Like, you know, it's fixed, so we just leave it alone. That's why we have the Acharya's books. This is the science. Yes?
Those two main principles, like always when the person will get, and Bhava means complete absorption, would it mean that in this stage, never forget paradise, like, disappears, minimizes?
There's a never forget, disappears. You could basically say, but until it comes to this, basically this rati, then there is that element that one is not forgetting by being absorbed in something material, but one could forget by not being absorbed in Krishna. Because if we say the jiva is marginal, what does marginal mean? Yeah, it's not within the category of prema, in other words, internal potency, and it's not within the mundane sphere. So that's why that point of being that we bring out the point that the taste of devotional service is beyond the state of liberation, because it's addressing us. Right? The internal potency couldn't care less about liberation, neither could the external energy. Right? Because external energy doesn't have to be liberated from itself. The internal potency, you know, doesn't have any interest in material nature and therefore needs to be liberated. It's only us that has that neutral tendency. Right? So until it comes to that platform, then you could say, but we're talking about very fine points. Because at the stage of bhava, there is no material conditioning. So one is liberated. Does that make sense? Yes.
One point is not discussed here, that bhava is attainable only by Krishna's mercy. It is not...
Yeah, well, maybe it comes up somewhere else, but... Because we have to remember, these are based on nectar devotion. You know, so any main points that are there. So they're just bringing to light these other... Because he's already explained, you know, it's been explained before, is that only by Krishna's mercy do you advance. So bhava is the same. Right? So basically, by sadhana, you can elevate yourself to asakti. But to get from asakti to bhava, that's only Krishna's blessing. Like that. You can't go beyond asakti without Krishna's blessing. But anyway, you're still only getting to asakti by Krishna's blessing. But it means there is no sadhana to bring it from asakti to bhava.
Maharaj, can I check to this paragraph which says... The devotee is always searching the sacred association.
Mm.
So in that environment, he would get
yes.
the mercy of Krishna.
Because it's by the association that you gain the devotional attitude. Right? That's why the preaching mission is set up as a society. Right? You know, different terms are used, but it's a society so that you have the association of devotees. Like that. So that's the idea, is that in that association you'll pick up their devotional mood, right? It's not that in that association then you'll find fault and, you know, thereby make yourself feel good. You know, it's supposed to be. These elements are removed. Yes?
When Madhya Yashoda sees cosmic manifestation in Krishna's mouth, is one of the secondary rasas temporarily cover her sthayi bhava?
No, because the point is it means Mother Yashoda, when the universal form happens, what happens to Arjuna when he sees the universal form?
He's scared. Reverent and fearful.
Yeah, reverent, fearful. So why is he fearful?
There's lack of identity,
right? So his relationship as Krishna's friend is suddenly kind of like put into question. So therefore he's fearful. But Mother Yashoda, her relationship with Krishna is never put into question. She just immediately thinks, wow, whatever I ate for breakfast, that didn't sit very well. She just is looking in bewilderment. You know, why would I see universes in my child's mouth? So it must be, you know. So it doesn't bother her at all. But, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't, as far as rasa goes. She's bewildered a bit. But that these are just different. That's what it mentions here. Your vibhava, vyavichari bhavas, these things, they may all make these anubhavas, they all make these little adjustments and give the different tastes, you know, especially the vyavichari, you know. But it doesn't... Her sthayi bhava doesn't adjust. Like that. Yes.
Also, when we see, like, in Chaitanya Charitamrita, the devotees... situated in Madhurya Rasa, tasting or relishing some Krishna Lila with another rasa, they do it from perspective of their own rasa, just appreciating Krishna in their rasa in different situation.
Yes. Yeah, because they don't... the point is can the mother appreciate her son playing with his friends. Like that. But it's her son who's playing with his friends and enjoying. It's like that. So there's no problem in someone actually in one rasa appreciating, you know, the exchange in other rasas. This is a concept, the concept that they can't, this is an idea of the sahajas. That, you know, we're in conjugal rasa, so we're not interested in any other rasa. But if we just apply that, extend that example, now again back to our the mother and the son, if, let's say, you know, the teacher is telling the mother how he's doing nicely at school and all that, he's a good student, she says, no, I don't want to hear, and she's just my son, I just want to absorb myself in our exchange, or... You know, she looks out the window and they're playing and he's happy and, oh, I'm not interested because I only can think about when I'm with him and that interact. Would we call this a good mother? No, we'd say something is strangely wrong here. Right? So that's the kind of devotional practices that the sahajas are recommending. Right? Another truth arises from this quotation. For the many different bodies of water, ponds, lakes, streams, rivers, and rivers, the ocean is their final destination and shelter. By the same token, the many incarnations of the Supreme Lord all display that rasa. But Lord Krishna, the source of all incarnations, like the ocean, is the only paramount emblem of that rasa. The initial transformations of Bhava reveal the Supreme Lord to the devotee. And later in Prema, the Rasika devotee directly perceives him as the absolute personification of the divine rasa. Yeah. So all these different elements, then rasa is there, but that interaction with Krishna in one's rasa, that's going to give that full taste. So there's before that, there's taste. And it's very great. It says the jiva exalts upon receiving it. But that when that's completely, when one is completely absorbed, when one's come to that platform of prema, then, you know, it's in another category of depth, right? Because the ocean is that unlimited. But it's still rasa, right? So the pond, the river, the lakes, streams, they're all rasa. Right? But the ocean is that where one becomes situated. So that one can unlimitedly, you know, swim in. Okay. So now, prema. Okay. Alongside the blossoming of prema, marvelous changes occur. The devotee's consciousness, previously entrapped by materialistic attachments for home and family, is now inspired by prema to disdainfully discard them and set itself free. Just as the touchstone jewel transforms ordinary objects to gems by touching them, by its potency, prema also miraculously transforms earthly attachments and makes them shine with sublime resplendence like its own self. Prema enfolds these attachments and bathes them in the nectar of the Supreme Lord's transcendental name, beauty, qualities, and so on. In footnote 3. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes in his commentary in Shloka 7 of Sri Shikshastaka, when Rati Bhakti reaches the state of Stai Bhava, or constancy in spiritual emotions, then in mixing together with the other four bhavas, Vibhava, Anubhava, Satvika Bhava, and Vyabhichari, it becomes transformed into Bhakti Rasa, or the sweet mellow of devotional service. In this stage, the ecstatic symptoms of Anubhava and Satvika Vichar find their full expression. Srila Rupa Goswami, in describing prema, writes in Bhakti Rasa Amrita Sindhu, Bhava Bhakti, which, from its very first stages, so excessively affects the heart that it melts and becomes a sublime salve of love, bringing the highest feelings of divine bliss within easy reach, and generates an intense desire for Krishna. The fully perfected souls term this over-vaulting ecstasy as prema. So, it's just that bhava has these elements, you know, that are there, but when it becomes complete, then that's prema, right? So in other words, just as this, the asakti and the beginning stages of bhava are basically the same, it's just the next natural step. So we see the beginning stages of, I mean, the latter stages of bhava and that of prema, then that will also have, right? Because there's always, you know, so we see there's always that overlap. The difficulty comes when we want these nice, clear definitions that there's nothing that connects. But if there's nothing that connects, why would it be the natural progression? You know what I'm saying? You're cooking. It's a hard potato. Then after you're done, it's a soft potato. But it's still a potato. No, but this potato is soft and that potato is hard. I'm confused. You know, how can the potato be both? You understand? That's the problems that we come up with. No, there has to be common ground. Otherwise, how is there a transformation? Milk transforms into yogurt. It's still the same. It's still dairy, but it's transformed. So that commonality is there. So without that commonality, how does one transform into the next? Right? We see also between ruchi and asakti, then there's not so much difference. Right? Just that taste is increased. Right? Does that make sense? You know, and so some will make a major division there. You know, anishta just means now you're fixed in your process of bhajana. Right? Well, before it was anishta. So between going from unfixed to fixed, then that makes a division. But it's still the same practices. Yeah? You understand? So you have these ways of dividing it so that you can see it very clearly in a particular way. And other ways may bring out a different definition, but it's the same thing. Right?
You mentioned that sometimes we think that like a magic pill or magic process will happen and things will be extremely different. But from what you're saying, it's just a transformation until it will lead to that.
Yes. Because you're basically uncovering what's naturally there. And then having uncovered it, then cultivating it in the association of the devotees. That's what's going on. But because we have a different taste and our focus is on the forms and activities rather than on the actual, transcendental rasa, like that. So then we become distracted. So this whole process, the sadhana bhakti, is there to engage us to. But all one's doing is uncovering the natural state, but it's covered by our attachments, so the attachments have to be removed. So that's done through the purificatory processes. Right? Does that make sense? So then you have, therefore, all these stages. Does that make sense? But you're emphasizing one element or another. Right? So it says, when Rati Bhakti reaches the stage of Stai Bhava, or consistency in spiritual emotions, right? So then it becomes, turns into bhakti ras. So here is saying when it becomes, he's looking at it here when the mood becomes fixed, right? Well, before we're looking at when the meditation is complete, because that's we're looking at the bhav sadhana. But what's happening means is one's becoming nishta in the state of sthaya bhava, right? Because one, in other words, just like in bhajana kriya, one knows, you know, one's position and one takes up the practices, right? But at the same time, it's not that one's fixed. So one will become fixed. So it's the same. There's not different processes, right? We like to make it out as that, oh, because we're doing this, then we have a new ritual. There's no new ritual. If it appears that it's changed forms, it's only going from one level to the next. It's a new manifestation of the same thing. Does that make sense? So that progression is using the same formulas. By developing the mood in the association of devotees, one takes up seriously that association. Gaining that mood, one takes up the process. Right? And then one is not so steady in the process. When one becomes steady in the process, then one can be directly engaged in these direct activities become more important to you. And then that gives rise to the taste, which then transforms, goes on. So that's all, the same thing is happening in bhava. Right? Does that make sense? You're associating with the residents of the spiritual world, and then you get adjusted with one's position, like that I'm servant of Krishna in this rasa, in this form, in this situation. And so then one wants to associate more, one takes on that mood, one is able to perform the activities that they give properly. And then that results in you being completely, all removal of any distraction is there, you're completely absorbed. So then at that time, then with the other aspects, then it goes on, because then that taste comes up. So then mixing together with the other four, you know, it becomes transferred into bhakti rasa. So that taste, that ruchi, then that becomes that full attachment, and then it turns into, you understand? So it's the same thing. That's why bhava's in its own category, because the same things that one did in sadhana bhakti, the internal purposes of it are happening in bhava, but it's not dependent upon the forms like it is in sadhana. Does that make sense? So that's why it's important, why Bhaktivinoda Thakur in that previous study is pointing out the internal meanings, the reasons that we're practicing the forms. If we don't understand that why we're practicing the forms, we'll miss the point. Right? Does that make sense? So that's why you can take the elements that apply to the externals from bhava-sadhana, and you can apply it in sadhana, bhakti. Right? So they all have their point. But the point is sadhana bhakti means you're engaging the body, mind, and words as the mechanical process. Bhava-sadhana, you're not engaging as a mechanical process. It's a spontaneous process, and it's with it's the spiritual facilities rather than material facilities. Understand? Same thing. Like that. Right? But, you know, a lot more elevated. It's on the Uttama platform rather than the Kanista and Madhya. Right? Does that make sense? Okay. When Rati Bhakti reaches the state of Stai Bhava, or constancy in spiritual emotions, then in mixing together with the other four bhavas, Vibhava, Anubhava, Sattvika, and Vyavichari, it becomes transformed into Bhakti Rasa, or the sweet mellow of devotional service. In this stage, the ecstatic symptoms of Anubhava and Sattvika Vikara find their full expression. Srila Rupa Goswami describes prema. Right before that is, they're there, but it's full is not until one comes to this point, where that bhakti rasa is you know, now manifest. Right before that, it's ecstasy. There's ecstatic symptoms, but it's what it can become is much greater. Does that make sense? Srila Rupa Swami, in describing prema, writes in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Bhava Bhakti, which from its very first stages so excessively affects the heart that it melts and becomes a sublime salve of love, bringing the highest feelings of divine bliss within easy reach. Right? So that means it's bringing that within reach. It hasn't reached that. Right? And generates an intense desire for Krishna. So that intense desire, the fully perfected souls term this overvolting ecstasy as prema. Right? So when it generates this intense thing, that's then when prema comes. So it's the natural thing that brings it within reach. Right? Because it's the bud. The bud turns into a flower. It's not that it becomes something else. It just opens. Like we're saying here, the beginning stages are like the shining, buds are like shiny. Right? That's their attractiveness. Right? There's no fragrance or this or that. But it's just, yeah, the shininess that, you know, how nicely it's there, it's made, you know. So that beginning, that attracts Krishna. And so by that association, then it blooms into prema. Okay. Where was that? Oh, that was up the top. Okay. The pure devotee thus begins to desire at every moment a direct audience with the Lord, right? So members were... We're talking now as we're going, transforming these. We've gone through bhava and taken it up to prema. Now we're starting to prema and dropping it down where in bhava it comes up. In a sense, there's going to be an overlap here. Does that make sense? In other words, like you were saying before, we're looking at it from the perspective of bhava. Now we're looking at it from the perspective of prema. Just like in a sakti, we looked at a sakti through into bhava, and then looked from bhava, looked back at the sakti, and then comes through. Right? Because you have to see both, right? You know, it's like the glass is half full, the glass is half empty. You have to be able to see both perspectives, right? Does that make sense? Because the one is, otherwise, how do you go move forward? But the other is, how do you enter where you're going to? Does that make sense? See, so, yeah. The burning arrow of extreme eagerness lacerates him, its intensity causing him dissatisfaction, despite his exulting in the Lord's sublime beauty and ambrosial pastimes. This is why we also have to get over this thing that an unfortunate situation is bad. That's a consideration of karma. Right? Because karma, I do good work, I get good situations. I do bad work, I get bad situations. Right? Because it's the situation that is, the situation, the attachment to it that's creating your uncomfortableness. Right? But if all that's in connection with Krishna, it's just another way of tasting the relationship with Krishna. Right? That's why these things aren't generally for general reading. Right? Does that make sense? It means we're going into these, into, you know, minor detail here. Like that. And already one will start hitting things that may cause doubts because of, how you say, our own attachments. Right? You know, like we saw in the Ishopanishad study, then, you know, getting rid of, understanding the nature of time and space. How these are continuums? That are connected with the jiva's conditioning by material nature. Otherwise, they're not, they don't exist. You know, they don't have that effect. So, a serious study of this, then we see, is on the Chaitanya Charitamrita level of study. Because then that's what's, so one has to have gone through all these levels to get to it. But here, because the nectar of devotion is given, then we're touching on this in connection with his explanations within the first section, right? We're not dealing with the second, third, and fourth sections, right? Otherwise, then you want to get into very detail about each one of these. Yes.
Maharaj, in Anathema, we have awesome affliction.
Awesome affliction.
So, and here it's saying he's not dissatisfied because of the problem. So I remember Sanatana Goswami, when he goes to see the Lord, he still carries that very beautiful chadar. He perceives in Sri Chaitanya's book something about the chadar, and so he goes and he changes his chadar with a beggar in that first time. So is that what he's, to get a deeper relationship when you see the mood of the Lord, and he went through this exchange for this very beautiful chadar for us.
He's saying that's true, but what's the relation? I don't quite catch.
Here, you're saying that the problems are not seen as something bad.
Oh, okay, yes. No, yes. It's just a matter, the Lord's playing a pastime. You know what I'm saying? And so then, let's say, you know, you and your friends are going to spend the afternoon, you know, fixing the car. Okay, so everyone shows up in their jeans and overalls and that, but one of your friends shows up in a suit. So you're going to be pleased? No, so it doesn't match what the mood. It's not that the chadar has any problem, you know, because that chadar is nothing compared to the chadars that, you know, they're using in the eternal lila, you know, in Vrindavan and stuff like that, but in the Leela here, then he's taking that of a renunciate, and so therefore, then it doesn't match. Does that make sense? Yeah. So then, yes. So it's all about the mood. It's all about the mood. So because the mood is there, and you see its connection to the Lord, therefore the seemingly unfortunate situation is not an unfortunate. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
That's correct. The pure devotee thus begins to desire at every moment a direct audience with the Lord. The burning arrow of extreme eagerness lacerates him, its intensity causing him dissatisfaction, despite his exulting in the Supreme Lord's sublime beauty and ambrosial pastimes. His desire fuels his frustration towards everything in general. Relations with friends, family, and other relatives lose meaning and resemble dried up wells because they're not going to get you Krishna. Right? In fact, you want direct audience and their connection is indirect. And so that's not, you can't get the direct, so how are you going to get the indirect? It means the direct meaning his, direct audience. It's direct service. Right? You have direct audience, the direct service, and then you have the indirect service. So why would indirect have any value at all when the direct is already creating the frustration that you're not getting the direct audience? Does that make sense? So automatically one just loses all interest in everything. Right. His home looms ominously before him like a forest of thorny bushes, and to even eat becomes a punishment. Pains like the bite from the poisonous fangs of a snake, and his daily chores and duties take on a deathly pallor. He carries the limbs of his body like unbearable weights. His well-wishers' consolations are like cloudbursts of noxious rains. His waking hours drown him in an ocean of repentance, and the rare moments of sleep become an intolerable torment. Right? What's interesting is he's going through everything that we take shelter of in the world. You know, everything, the praise people give, the consolations that they give, all the facilities and family members and everything that we would take as, you know, this is what, you know, we're out in the outside and it's a really tough day, and then we come home and yes, now shelter. So all these things of shelter is just like complete. Yes.
Eating becomes a punishment.
Each year, chewing, each one, you know, it's like in the thing where they go into slow motion and, you know, you hear the. You know what I mean? Yeah, it's like. Yeah, you could do some good screenplays with that aspect, right? And he's not over yet. Right? Living becomes a burden of guilt, a censure from providence. Like scorched patty, meditations are devoid of substance, and activities which had early given him satisfaction now lack purpose. Right, so sitting down and going through your formal meditations doesn't mean anything. Those activities before that he connected nicely to Krishna, you know, that before gave him so much satisfaction in the household life, now have absolutely mean nothing. You know, so in other words, all this just reminds him that he's not with Krishna. So therefore, it's a problem. Even remembering the Lord's lotus feet becomes an excruciating effort and feels as if someone was tearing him limb from limb. So this is the element of separation. Right? It's becoming. So, but it is directly the Lord, but its intensity is so much greater. Like that. But that naturally gives rise to sambhog, which then will intensify the. So this is why we just talk to, you know, chant Hare Krishna, be happy, you know, these kind of things. Because some devotees are told this too, and they just, you know, that's it, I'm not doing this. You know, especially ones that are very worried about liberation. Because the material world pains them so much, they just want to get out of it. So that's why this discussion is in this particular place. At a later stage, prema assumes the character of a strong magnet, drawing to itself even Lord Krishna, the all-attractive iron. One day prema arranges for the pure devotee a direct audience with the Lord. Also, we have to remember in here is that when we're talking about prema, then here we're discussing a generic category, right? So we're not distinguishing technically between the 10 levels, right? So prema as such, as a level, is the second. So when we're going Shraddha Prema, we're talking about the second level. But Bhava is the first level. So it's counted as part of Prema. But it's the bud. Right? So that's why there'll be this overlap. Is that so? Right, because it said before is that when you go next, when you're fully absorbed in Krishna, that will draw Krishna. right? So now we're looking at it from the perspective of prema, how you're starting from the early stages of prema, in other words, bhava, and coming up until it becomes, you know, that sthayi bhava becomes completely fixed. The Supreme Lord reciprocates by revealing to the pure devotee his intimate, divine, and auspicious attributes, such as his ravishing beauty, physical fragrance, melodious voice, ever-fresh youthfulness, versatile love, magnanimity, and compassion. Right? So the others is the situation is being seen. Right? So now the qualities come up. You understand? So even here in this, then this name, form, qualities, pastimes, it's going through the same stages. You know what I'm saying? But at a much greater, more intense platform. Does that make sense? Because it's the qualities that is what is attracting one, right? One has a goal. It's the quality of the goal that you're attracted to. But we mistake that it's the form. We think the form, just as we think that matter has generated life, so we think matter is generating our inspiration, our attraction to it. Right? It's the same thing. So we make the mistake, but here's the point, it's the qualities. Right? But now the qualities aren't like before, as we're discussing the qualities on the Brahman and Paramatma level. Now we're discussing qualities on the Bhagavan. But now it means that we've appreciated it on that level, on the Bhagavan level. But now he reveals it directly. Right? Does that make sense? So there's that ecstasy of associating with Krishna. But now it's like the senses become involved in that meditation. You understand? Before it's the mind. Now the senses become absorbed. Right? So what Krishna smells like, what his voice sounds like. Does that make sense? All these. That's why this can only be accomplished, generally speaking, in the spiritual form. One can get up to this point in the material body. It means someone in the sadhaka rupa can get to these stages of how you say, bhav sadhana, perfect, bringing up to prema, but only that much. It can't go beyond like that. So is it going to progress beyond this? Then they have, that can only be appreciated in the spiritual form. Right? Because the material body is only so strong. Yes.
And what about, how does it relate to those who already have spiritual form and come down here? Can they appreciate those attributes in their form here? When Siddha, person who has spiritual form, comes here in sadhaka rupa.
Okay. Okay, that, because that you didn't say before. I'm thinking, how the Lord comes down with his eternal associates and they're all in spiritual form. What's the problem? Okay, so the point is that kind of relishing is done in their original form. So this form is for preaching and giving that association. But, you know, what they do in their spare time, that's, you know, beyond our understanding. Is that okay? Okay, so all these attributes, then, Lord reciprocates by revealing to the pure devotee his intimate, divine, and auspicious attributes, which the pure devotee directly perceives with his senses, right? Because before this was meditation. This is the distinction. Before was meditation, so now it's directly with his senses. So that means the intensity will be so much greater. As these attributes are nectarian and dynamic, prema produces in the devotee's heart an ever-increasing powerful desire to fully relish the Lord's transcendental qualities. The devotee finds himself swimming in an unlimited ocean of bliss that no words can adequately describe. Right? So this is where they just stop describing, right? Because they can't. You know, you get some hint in the poetry. But you can get some hint from here, how he's taking out. Because he does say ravishing beauty, physical fresh, melodious voice, ever fresh. So there's always these adjectives being used. Because the adjectives are what the mind catches on. Right? Voice is a noun. Right? Melodious voice, then it brings out, though it's you're still describing the noun, but it gives something for the mind to catch on. Right? Otherwise, you just, voice is a category of bringing in knowledge to the senses, but melodious, then that takes on a quality. You understand? So that's why the devotee is poetic. Because then they're always describing what is being tasted. Right? That makes sense? So that's what's special. Yes.
When Narottamdas Thakur takes the pram with Sri Gauranga left for him, and he sees this golden boy entering his mind, is this one of his qualities he's describing? Only directly to Gauranga?
It depends what they're saying there. If he's experiencing the relishing the various aspects of that, then yes. Otherwise, then you're talking about before. But knowing that it's someone like him, I would say yes, it's this.
And he gets mad and doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, because it's all these things are happening. So one is enough to throw you off balance, let alone all five. That's also why the spiritual form is necessary. Because on the material platform, the mind only deals with one sense at a time. It doesn't deal with more. But on the spiritual platform, then you're dealing with all five at once. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the yeah. So yeah. When prema blossoms, the Lord reveals first his form of matchless beauty to the enraptured devotee. The devotee's senses and mind become one, and he beholds. Okay. The devotee's senses and mind become one, and he beholds with all his senses the Lord's exquisite beauty. So all the senses are beholding the beauty. Right? Because in the spiritual form, any sense can do the interaction of any of the others. So instead of just one, you know, seeing the beauty of the Lord, all five are seeing the beauty of the Lord. Right? So then that would be... Yeah, you know, it means you just see, you can imagine all your skin is seeing also. You know, somebody says, it's just, you know, what's going on? At the sight of the Lord's unparalleled beauty, the devotee feels ecstatic symptoms, astasattvika vichara, like being paralyzed, quivering, weeping, and so on. These ecstatic symptoms begin to hinder his vision of the Lord. Not only that, but the exhilaration renders him unconscious. So... again, obstacles. It cannot be refuted that the devotee can taste to his complete satisfaction all the different qualities of the Lord. Nor can it be argued that he relishes full bliss at this stage. Right? So he's making the point is, you don't make the distinction that, well, he can't taste everything to his complete satisfaction, but at the same time, you can't say that the full bliss is being tasted at this point, either. In other words, the Lord, whatever, any manifestation is perfect and complete, but there's also more perfect and more complete. You know what I'm saying? This possible owing to the Lord's wonderful and inconceivable potency that helps the devotee concurrently perceive all the Lord's attributes with his five senses in the mind. This naturally inspires the devotee beyond imagination. Right? Maybe this is your fourth dimension you were talking about the other day. But your quantum physicist is not going to get this one.
Statement like that in Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Prabhupada said the Lord exists beyond in the fourth dimension, in Turiya.
The interesting thing is, if you take it like this, is that if you use that as a basis for a presentation, then you could say that the fourth, there is a fourth dimension, but that's the Brahman. You know, that's Paramatma. So that level is what's actually making things work that the scientists won't be able to see with his numbers. You know, so so you could say there is a fourth dimension, but not a dimension that they're talking about that they're going to catch with their numbers. You know, it's only by you know, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra that they'll be able to catch it. Then one can see that, but one won't be able to relish it unless it is done with devotion. The pure devotee is eager to relish altogether each of the Lord's sublime attributes, such as his exquisite beauty. But just as a swallow with its beak shut tight is unable to slake its thirst even when it rains, so the devotee is also hapless on his own against the Lord's opulences in dating his senses. Seeing the devotee's predicament, the Lord thinks, is this confusion the purpose of my matchless beauty? So the Lord offers to the devotee his seventh opulence, compassion. This opulence is the headmistress of all the other attributes. It is she who is enthroned in the corolla of the eight-petaled lotus, consisting the eight potencies like Vimala, Utkarshini, and so on, known collectively as Surup Shakti, the Lord's internal potency. That's interesting. Because you have all these they'll worship, like when you do the Pancharatrik worship, then you worship all these energies. But it's not explained so effortlessly as in here. Or it's just there are all the Lord's, you know, how you say, potencies. And then compassion is sitting there in the middle of it. Yes?
Sometimes, they describe the Lord as three principal energies, O, Nila, and Lila. They correspond to
Sambit, Sannidhi, Gladini. Means those are the potencies, these are personalities of the potencies. But that particular manifestation, the terminology is what was used in connection with Vaikuntha. But it's the same principle. It means they came from before that. Right? Does that make sense? Vaikuntha has to come from Dwarka, Dwarka from Mathura, Mathura from Vrindavan. So it's the same principles. Right? You know. So you're having your right, left, and middle. So it's going to be the same. You know, Kladini will be Sri. Your Sundini will be Nila or Lila, and your Sambit will be Bhu. The seventh opulence of the Lord is also known as anugraha, or mercy, right? So here you're looking at the qualities, you're not attributing to the specific person, because Sarup Shakti is the complete potency. But, you know, so he's not specifically discussing Radharani here, or Yogamaya, right? So this is the element where Krishna is, him and his energies are non-different, or him and the qualities are non-different. You know, so Bhagavan, Paramatma are non-different. But on this level, because when we discuss Brahman, then we think of the element of the all-pervadingness, and like that, not so much. But here, we're discussing that same thing, but on the platform of the personality of Godhead. Right? Does that make sense? It's the same principle, but the qualities are so overwhelmingly attractive. On the material world, we use it to get beyond our attachments to here. We have objects of affection here, but it's the qualities of the Lord that are beyond that that creates that attraction. But we are mistaking it for that external. Right? So those all get in the way. So here, it's without that. It's the qualities in the Lord. They are coming from the Lord. It is Him. It's non-different. So that attraction to those qualities is Him. Right? In other words, the form, it is Him. Right? While here, we're attracted to the quality, but the form is not Him. You know, it's defined by His laws. Right? But it's just another energy. While here, you're actually directly dealing with Him. Does this make sense? The seventh opulence of the Lord is also known as anugha, or mercy. So compassion and mercy, you know, different aspects of the same. She manifests herself in the Lord's lotus eyes in varied splendor. To the dasya bhakta, she is compassion. To the vatsalya bhakta, he is filial fondness. And to the madhurya bhakta, she is heart-melting magnetic power. In this way, she appears in different loving moods of the devotees. Right? Because remember before we were saying that the inherent love of the jiva, depending upon where it's reposed, it has that takes on that quality. You understand? So it's still the same love, but it's being addressed in a particular place. Right? Does that make sense? You know, so that love for the house then is that feeling of security. You understand? But it's actually just the perverted, misdirected love for Krishna. Right? But here then, it's being applied so that that mercy of the Lord, when it's being applied, it takes on all these different flavors. Right? So again, you're just coming down to that, you know, the Lord's compassion, that's the love. He's giving an example. You know, because he'll just say friendship on this, but here is compassion, the magnetic power, and then you're giving something in between. The scriptures have identified 18 human shortcomings that go against its tenets. They are as follows. In other words, these are what Shastra does not recommend that you're trying to remove. They are as follows. Illusion, sleepiness, uncivility, lust, greed, madness, envy, cruelty, lamentations, over-endeavor, deceit, anger, desire, fear, mistakes, intolerance, and dependence. The scriptures proclaim that the Lord's qualities are absolutely free from these discrepancies. Occasionally, Kripa Shakti arranges the display of some of these discrepancies in the dealings of Krishna, Rama, and so on. And the devotees then perceive them. By the ingenuity of Kripa Shakti, however, these same faults are transformed from banality to divine magnificence. They become converted to transcendental excellences, embellishing the Lord's personality. In order to delight in the Lord's divine qualities, which the Lord Himself so explicitly exhibits, the enlightened and powerful devotees in the latter stage of prema has to constantly and repeatedly relish them. Right? So it's not a matter of he could if he wants. He has to. It's just that's the need. That's why we prayojan is divine is need. So this is the ultimate need is to be to need to just be absorbed in that wonderfulness of Krishna. Simultaneously, as these qualities blossom to their fullest possible expression, the devotee's heart floods with wonder, sweeping him to perfection. He realizes that the Lord's bhakta vatsalya quality, protective love for his devotees, is beyond compare. Again and again he remembers the Lord's magnanimity, melting his heart with sublime emotion. So this principle is given down. So in the Bhogarti, Bhajabhakata Vatsala Shri Gaurah, like this. So that mercy. So in this age, then that's what's being distributed, is that mercy. But then it's a matter of this is the extent of which that mercy applies. Right, so it can be appreciated. up to this level. Right, or yeah. Right. So we're just saying is, oh, you know, pick them up. This, but what does that mean? You pick someone up or save them from their condition or that. It means that it's going to keep increasing until it comes to the point of this. Right. So that's where it starts. Again and again he remembers the Lord's magnanimity. Melting his heart with sublime emotions. The Supreme Lord acknowledges his devotee's feelings and says to him, "My dear devotee, you have sacrificed wife, children, wealth, and home countless times in many births. You have tolerated such sufferings as the ravages of scorching summers, freezing winters, hunger, thirst, pain, and disease, only so you could serve me as I had asked you to. You have disregarded a million humiliations from others and maintained your life by begging. Yet so far I've been unable to reciprocate with you and offer you anything. This makes me indebted to you. Now tell me, what can I offer you? Lordship of the entire universe, the position of Lord Brahma, all the mystic opulences, and so on are not befitting. Hence how can I offer them to you? It is becoming of a gentleman to offer grass, straw, and other animal fodder. Is it becoming of a gentleman to offer grass, straw, and other animal fodder to a human being?" So in other words, all these other things, they wouldn't compare to what the devotee has, you know, done for Krishna. "Considering all this, I offer myself to you. Although I am unconquerable and indomitable, I am won over by you. I am now your property. I shall simply depend on your gentle disposition." Yes.
You see a difference in flavor between these statements and the one that Bhakti Maharaj on the Bhagavatam.
Yes.
The Lord is offering anybody the benediction he wants.
Yeah.
Here he's putting himself.
Yeah, he's saying it's I won't even bother offering.
Yes.
You know. You know, but Prithu Maharaj rejects them all.
Yeah.
But that, you know, because that's the appropriate thing. That's the interaction. You know? So that's why these are special. They're the same principle. But, you know, the taste is, it has a different flavor. The Lord, yes.
How can we make a difference between compassion and mercy?
Between compassion and mercy, they're the same. He's saying there that it says, so the Lord offers to the devotee his seventh opulence, compassion. This opulence is the head mistress of all the other attributes. The seventh opulence of the Lord is also known as anugraha, or mercy. Right? Because compassion means, mercy means it's being applied, you know? Like that.
There are also, like, in Sanskrit I've heard there are three or four stages of compassion.
Okay.
Like, first is kripa, or just like appreciation or empathic feeling. Later is anugraha, which like is more involved.
Okay.
Maybe there is one more.
Because kripa is also known as mercy, I guess.
Okay. And there is, the best is anukampa, when one does actually for the suffering person.
Could you please describe how dependency goes against the tendencies of
life? How dependency? Because he's independent. He doesn't require. He's not dependent upon anything else. The ones mentioned here. No, these are the ones that condition soul. Yeah, dependency means you're dependent upon material manifestations. The soul is transcendental, but you're dependent on your happiness on, you know, your home or your money or all these other things. So that's dependency. The Lord doesn't have that. Does that make sense?
Okay. I was thinking that we shouldn't have that quality.
That's the point that it's making. We're dependent on the Lord, but here it says scriptures have identified 18 human shortcomings that go against this tenet. That means the dependency on material objects. These are all material, right? Illusion means not understanding the Lord. Sleepiness means there's no enthusiastic to be involved in the Lord or take that uncivility. You know, you're uncultured because you don't see anyone and everything in connection with the Lord. Lust, that you've taken your love that's meant for the Lord and applied it to the material surroundings. You understand? So that's what it means there. That's why you have to see the context. It's not just the specific of the word. Because then it goes on to say is that Yogamaya will make it appear that these qualities, same mundane qualities, are appearing in the Lord's pastimes. Right? But it's just for some fun. They're transcendental. They're in no way like the material things. It's just the taste of rasa. Ravana steals Sita, and now Ram, being dependent upon her for his affection, then is lamenting, right? And then he's dependent upon his servants to go out and find where Sita is. He's dependent upon his servants to help him fight the battle. But, you know, there's no question that Ravana could steal Sita and that, but then where's the pastime? Right? If he doesn't feel bad, why would everybody? If he's like, you know, like that, you know, how are you doing today? Yeah, great. You know, anything new today? Yeah, Robin is called Sita. You know, it's cool. Yeah. Like that. Oh, okay. You know. Yeah.
Now I have
more
time for
job.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, you know, don't have to go hunting any golden deers and that. So, you know what I'm saying? So it says, what will the devotees do? What will they? So it creates this. You know, Lord Chaitanya can save everybody, but he's saying, who's going to save them? Right? So Rupa Goswami says, I'll save them. And then he's happy. You know, so that's it's manifest just for these kind of... The Lord's ambrosial words enter the devotee's ears like curly drops of nectar. The devotee replies, wow, this just keeps going on. And this is the summary. The devotee replies, my dear Lord, O Supreme Person, you're an ocean of mercy. Seeing me swept away by the swift currents of gross materialism and becoming the helpless prey of the cruel venomous snake of time, you took pity on me. Your petal-soft heart melted, and to remove my lust and nescience, you appeared before me as the most perfect spiritual preceptor. Your appearance is awe-inspiring, like the powerful presence of the Sudarshana chakra is to his natural energies. You thus rescued me from the horrendous poisonous fangs and grim black coils of the snake of time. Any other questions? So we'll continue tomorrow with the reply of the devotee. Okay. Then at 10:30 we'll get back to Tantra.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Śrīla Prabhupāda ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nityānanda Gaura Prema ki.